We've got 3 weeks before the latest round of state budget funding expires. And what, if anything, are lawmakers doing in Springfield to fix this? We'll talk about that. Also, what happens when you bring scientists and artists together to work with supercomputers?
Getting people together is part of the artwork. Research artists, technologists, and the computationalists.
That's Donna Cox, a professor of art and design at the University of Illinois and director of the eDream Project. We'll talk with her about efforts to use digital technologies to promote the arts. And finally, we speak with Chicago musician Vivian McConnell about making music. Her band, Grandkids, is releasing their latest album next week.
Trying to find the balance between, okay, how much time do we put into music and how much time do we put into finding a job, you know, trying to find that balance, I think, has been the hardest part.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Today, what do supercomputers have to do with arts and humanities? And how can you teach computers to better understand and imitate subtle human movements? Those are some of the questions that researchers at the University of Illinois are exploring as part of a project known as eDream. The team, along with researchers from 19 other universities, received a $110 million grant from the National Science Foundation earlier this summer to help support their work. To help us learn more about this, we're joined by Donna Cox. She's a professor of art and design at the University of Illinois. She's the director of both eDream and the Advanced Visualization Laboratory at the National Center for Supercomputing Applications, or NCSA, at the university. We're also joined by Kyung-ho Lee, a graduate student at the university in the Illinois Informatics Institute. Donna, Kyung-ho, thank you so much for being with us.
Hello.
Thank you for having us.
Donna, maybe you can explain what is the, the whole point of eDream is to help merge arts and humanities. What's the goal of the project?
The goal and the mission is to foster an interdisciplinary collaboration between the arts, designers, technologists, and scientists. So we're fostering creativity and bringing disciplines together. We have supported a number of students over the years through the Fiddler Innovation Endowment. The whole eDream concept grew out of the Advanced Visualization Laboratory at the NCSA, where we do work as an interdisciplinary team with scientists from who use supercomputers. And we take the numerical data from the supercomputers and design that data into beautiful images that you can see and understand and that are included in movies. So this was a bringing together of art, technology, and science through data visualization. And the polishing and the production quality that we bring to these images are artistic endeavors as well as technological endeavors. And we work very hard with scientists to understand what the data means and to be and to represent it appropriately. So we work in these interdisciplinary teams.
And so when I'm thinking about that, a practical example of that, when we're thinking about movies, the most recent project that you all worked on, when you're visualizing on a screen images of space.
Yes.
And sometimes there are, I guess, when you do that, because there's a lot of numerical quantitative analysis,
yes.
But then there's also the visual side of that. So
yes.
how do you mesh that, like the artistic side of that? Does it come down to even deciding the specific colors of things within space?
Camera motion, where to point the view. There's a cinematic language that's grown up over the years, and we present science cinematography. These cinematic rules to present science to the public. So it's the cinematic presentation of scientific data that comes from supercomputers. Now, supercomputing and computational science and visualization, as we know it today, was really pioneered at the NCSA. So eDream has really grown up out of this kind of convergence at the center of these interdisciplinary teams that work together on the arts and the sciences and the humanities. And the instantiation of that today is I'm also the acting director of the research and education arm of NCSA, and we deal with hundreds of scientists and local campus faculty affiliates from all across campus. The Illinois Program for Research in the Humanities, we're helping to support the new design dialogues that Anita Chan is helping to bring speakers on the topics of technology, the humanities, and the new areas that are being forged.
So you all are doing, so you're talking about NCSA, the supercomputing level of computation, the artistic layer that you put on this, and now this new collaboration, eDream. There's one project in particular I wanted to ask you guys about, because it's the whole idea is this looks at sort of human media interactions. This one project you're doing called Moving Stories. And when we think about human media interaction, I think the thing that comes to mind immediately for a lot of people maybe would be something like Pokemon Go,
yes,
where we're looking at how much we've used technology and sort of put how much the human experience is a part of that. Is that a good example of what we mean when we say human media interaction?
That is one example, but there are technologies today that basically sense and track the body. And Moving Stories is a collaboration that eDream is working with Simon Fraser University and a consortium of universities to track the body and to extract meaning from that data that's coming off of the body and to better understanding the human intention. And I'm going to turn
yeah,
it over
so,
to
Yeah, and so, Hyung-ho, this is
Hyung-ho.
Exactly what you're doing, right? Because
yeah,
you're working
right.
on machine learning, but detecting subtle human movements. How are you doing that?
Actually, it's not detecting. It's kind of recognition.
Recognition, okay.
Yeah, that's because machine learning is a subset field of computer science or artificial intelligence that investigate how algorithms can learn from observations from data and generate new knowledge or intelligence.
So you're actually building artificial intelligence. You're trying to have the machines learn and recognize human movements. How are you doing that?
Well, we can record a conductor's gestures in a motion capture studio using Microsoft Kinect version 2, and we feed the information of human body, like 27 joint of human body movement at 30 times per second, and we can feed the information to the exit system, one of exit system, so-called Stampede, and then we can analyze the movement through different algorithms with a lot of parameters.
So what you're doing is, do you have professional conductors, you're bringing them into a lab, you're having them conduct a classical music piece. How many different cameras do you have? What's the kind of setup for something like this to have? Because I imagine, and this is obviously, we'll get to the supercomputing part in a second of how many of the part, the computation that needs to be done with this, but how does that setup, what does that even look like?
It's like finding a optimal spot to get the best accuracy or result from conducting gestures.
So do you have cameras all over the place?
We have 5 Kinect in a studio, and we use that device to sense the subtle part of human body movement.
Okay.
So it means that.
So, and what's the point of, why is the focus on the subtle movement like that a conductor makes? Why did you choose that?
That's because generally, many scientists, they have focused on recognizing the very typical movement, like handshaking, waving hand, and
obvious things, like
yeah.
right.
But we are more focusing on the subtle, qualitative part of the human body movement, so we can get or we can define what is the expressibility or what is the expression, true meaning, or the nature of the expression of human.
This is a really hard question. How do you teach a computer? How are you teaching a computer to try to? Because you're trying to teach. What are you trying to get the computers to learn? What machine learning are you trying to get them to do?
It is simply, it is a stochastic process to get some patterns from the data, like we collected, and then computers put a numerous variables, like let's say we can feed a velocity of the
Music or of this, yeah.
No.
Oh, I mean, of their movements, you're actually saying.
And then
okay,
we can
sure.
feed acceleration, or maybe we can feed curvature measure to find angular movement in the conducting gesture, and then okay. we can feed all the numerical data into the computers so that we can get some result. Let's say then computers returns this is 70% of staccatoic movement, or maybe this is 99% of sostenitoic movement.
Interesting. So Donna, when we think about this, you know, other news coverage we read about this type of research talks about hypothetical scenarios about how this could be really helpful to filmmakers one mm-hmm. day. If you mm-hmm. were, and I wonder, say you film a movie with some famous actor on a remote island, the film's over and you return back and you realize, oops, we need to reshoot something. Is this how this would help us sort of having machine learning predict a very subtle human behavior? Would this be something where it could happen eventually where this is where you would use this for you all with to help recreate movements?
Well, machine learning really is a way that through statistical methods that the machine responds to whether or not it's doing the right thing or not. It's learning from some kind of input from the person. So, yes, you could have a very intelligent camera. You could have a virtual intelligent camera that could learn from a real cinematographer how to make subtle moves and control this camera remotely. Mm. So we can think of the future as being machine learning really filling in the space that humans point you in the direction of something, and then the computer can continue to nudge and be nudged by the humans to be affirmed that this is the right direction to go. Now, that being said, I think that it's important that the humanists come and really talk about what this means in machine learning, artificial intelligence for people, in computational science for data. And we have these discussions, and they ask different questions, and that's why the humanists and artists are important with the scientists, because machine learning, the computer can learn, AI can learn, but maybe it's learning the wrong things. Maybe we're incorporating our biases into
sure.
those methods of teaching.
Right,
and if we don't have... Mm-hmm. a data of inclusion, if we're missing half the population and they're not being represented, then we will just teach them the wrong
right,
things.
Right, because we've sort of seen early iterations of this kind of disastrous bot situations, right? But when we're thinking about machine learning with the work that Kyung-ho, what you're doing, would this technology learning, this machine learning of subtle movements, would this help, for example, improve virtual reality? Is this for
yes.
robotics?
Yes.
All of these kind of, these are kind yes. of where we're seeing these practical applications.
Absolutely. And this is, we're teaching the machine the best path to go up to a point and then letting it take over on some of the tasks that would be too arduous and manual. So there are these algorithms that are getting better and better because we're training them and we're learning from them.
And why, and I guess because is the computational level of this to the extent that this has to be done at a supercomputing facility?
Not always.
Yeah, that's because let's say if you get a decent brand new version of Macro machine,
right,
which costs $5,000, it has only like 12 cores in the desktop. Sometimes if we want to analyze some movement, mm-hmm. it'll take 24 hours or maybe sometimes like 30 hours. But through the supercomputers, we can make it like less than 4 hours or maybe even 1 hour.
I see. So it's just the speed at which it's processing.
That's right. It accelerates our research project.
And in fact, you do this right, Kyung Ho. I understand one of the nice things about this research is you can set up calculations to run on a Friday, and then they run all weekend. So when you get back into the office on Monday, the data is ready for you to analyze.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. And where are these computers physically located that you're working with, Kyung Ho?
The Stampede TACC machine is located at the University of Texas.
Okay, Austin. So you're working with the supercomputing facility in Texas.
From here.
From here.
Yeah.
That's what XSEED does. That is a consortium of all kinds of facilities distributed all over.
So these are the 19 different facilities.
Yes.
Across the country?
And yes. And the user does not want to have to know where they're being computed. It's you can think of it as a cloud, but it's not. I mean, there's special purpose computers located in various locations. And then, of course, we have the extremely large, one-of-a-kind Blue Waters supercomputer right here on campus.
And so then people across the country obviously are also using Blue Waters.
Yes.
That's here in Urbana. Just like, Kyung Ho, you're using the one in Texas.
Right.
For less than a minute, just very quickly, I wonder, where do you see this going? What's next for you guys with this application?
Hey, Kyung Ho, where do you see this going with your research?
I can imagine that we can build a machine symphony or virtual orchestra.
Wow.
Yeah, let's say we can. If you can build a good model to recognize some subtle gesture from conducting
Then you could build a robot conductor.
Yeah, synthesize or generate a new set of subtlety.
Wow. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Kyung Ho Lee is a graduate student at the University of Illinois. Donna Cox directs the eDream project and also teaches art and design at the University of Illinois and directs the Advanced Visualization Laboratory. We'll have more research about this. We'll put all of this out online. If you follow us on Twitter, 21STShow, you can see more about the eDream. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. After saying that leaders would meet every day to come up with a solution to the Illinois state budget crisis, Governor Rauner canceled today's meeting. Through a spokesperson, the governor said he would meet when Democrats were ready with a proposal. We're 3 weeks from another self-imposed crisis point when the stopgap spending plan runs out for the state. And of course, that's just more talk. And what action are we seeing? AP State House correspondent Ivan Moreno summed it up this way in a story the other day. He wrote, legislative leaders and Republican Governor Rauner are succeeding more at frustrating each other than striking a deal to end an 18-month impasse that is damaging the state's fiscal health every day. Ivan's on the line with us right now from Springfield, along with Jordan Abadea, who's a political reporter with WICS News Channel 20 in Springfield. Ivan, Jordan, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Ivan, let's start with you. Since the November election ended, there's been, as promised, regular meetings between the leader and the governor. What's the backstory about why today's was canceled?
Well, so the governor's office says that they had requested that Democratic leaders present them with some sort of budget outline, budget proposal, to be discussed today. They say that they had learned that that was not going to happen, that they were not going to get any sort of budget proposal, some sort of starting point from Democrats today. And so they said, you know, we're going to delay this meeting until you are ready to present us with a proposal. It kind of took Democrats a little aback, I think, that they were expecting for this meeting, and it sounded like they were not really thinking that this was having to present a budget proposal was necessary to meet with the governor. And in fact, the spokesperson for House Speaker Michael Madigan said it should be the governor who should be presenting us with a budget. So that's where things stand and why this meeting was canceled. Again, they've been meeting almost every day the last couple of weeks.
Jordan, I guess it begs the question, we're hearing Governor Rauner saying, I want a proposal. Democrats are saying the governor should be presenting a proposal. What has been going on in these meetings if they're meeting every day? Do we have a sense of any kind of action or any kind of movement being worked out?
So, of course, these meetings are always held behind closed doors. But what we get from when the leaders emerge from these meetings are little details that trickle out here and there. I mean, obviously, a budget needs to be talked about, but I think the leaders, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, are much closer on what an actual budget looks like. Everyone understands that there will be need to be some cuts in spending. Everyone understands that there will eventually need to be more revenue as part of the solution. But really where the sticking point is are on these turnaround reforms. And I think that's where a lot of the negotiations have taken place. We've seen Speaker Madigan leave the meeting and say, well, we've only talked about the budget for 15 minutes this meeting, but we talked about workers' comp reform, or we talked about pension reform, or we talked about term limits, these kinds of things. So I think that's where a lot of the negotiations have really centered, are around these reforms and what Democrats would be willing to vote on and take up on the floor and what these reforms should look like. And of course, Democrats for almost 2 years now have been saying these reforms have nothing to do with the budget. Let's just pass the budget by itself.
And clearly, Jordan, we're at a point where 2 years in, that doesn't seem like that's likely to happen. Can you remind us again of what Governor Rauner's turnaround agenda is, what he's focusing on now? Because we've heard a slightly different iterations of what he'd like to focus on over the past 2 years. What do you think are the, or sort of, you mentioned three things. Are those the three main things we're thinking as part of the turnaround agenda now?
He's really pushing five main things, and he's said for the past few weeks now after the election that he doesn't need all of these five things. He just needs meaningful reform. So really what we're looking at is workers' compensation reform. We're looking at a property tax freeze that would include local control over things like collective bargaining and prevailing wage. And then we're looking at term limits, redistricting reform. Those types of things are all things that he wants to see as part of a final deal. Of course, pension reform that was contingent upon Chicago Public Schools getting their pension payment from the state. So there are, he's got about five main issues. He said he doesn't need all five of these. He needs some combination of them that would be meaningful.
Ivan, what are we hearing from House Speaker Madigan and other Democrats about how likely they are to accept any movement on those five items that Jordan just outlined for us?
So Senate President Cullerton has told us after these meetings that he's willing to discuss some of these issues like workers' compensation, et cetera. But House Speaker Michael Madigan, who really is a very key player here, has been very firm going back to before the election and after the election that the only way that there's going to be a budget agreement is if it doesn't include any of Rauner's demands. And he says this, not in those words, but he says this after every meeting. So that's really a major sticking point there, because if you don't have him on board, there's never going to be a deal. And he is really been firm again on not backing off of what he's saying, that Rauner's demand need to be off the table.
Jordan, Ivan, either of you jump in here, because you guys are at, you guys are staking out these meetings every day. You're listening to the language that they, the statements that they're making. Are either of you sensing any change in Speaker Madigan's tone or words after the, or we're hearing any difference in what he's saying over the past couple of weeks?
I haven't heard anything different. I actually, once these meetings started up again a couple weeks in, I actually was talking to some other reporters that are on the State House beat, and I did a story and I pulled up sound bites from before the election 6 months ago when we were getting a stopgap budget and those negotiations were going on, and the sound bites that were coming out after these meetings, and they are literally almost word for word the exact same thing
that they were saying 6 months ago, Jordan.
Yeah, so, and it's not just Speaker Madigan. I mean, it's the Republicans as well. I mean, everybody's rhetoric is the exact same that it was 6 months ago.
Okay. Well, and we were thinking about this. I mean, do we even, so it sounds like nothing's changed in 6 months. At this point, the leaders are even arguing about whether or not they're going to have meetings. In public, they're saying that the tone is respectful, but I know that actions speak louder than words here. What, I mean, Ivan, what's your sense of Governor Rauner saying we're not going to meet anymore? Do you feel like that's a sense of saying, what's behind that? Is he just saying, I'm really not going to do anything until you work on my turnaround agenda? But he's saying, but I want to see a budget proposal?
No, I mean, he definitely wants to see Democrats give him something, because his argument all along has been that we need to have a budget that is as he puts it, fiscally responsible, that is balanced, and that includes some of his pro-business ideas to, he says, grow the economy and fix the state long term. But like I said, I mean, Democrats, particularly Michael Madigan, really don't see it that way. And Madigan has stressed, in addition to saying that Rauner's demands should not be part of a budget deal, he has said that the biggest issue facing the state is one of revenue. I mean, what he's hinting at there is that basically we should find ways to raise revenue, i.e. taxes. And I think there is a general consensus that that will be needed. Neither side is willing to stick their neck out by themselves. That's why you have Rauner asking for something in exchange for that.
One thing that did happen, and we're thinking about Governor Rauner talking about the state and growing the economy. Yesterday, he signed a bill that will subsidize Exelon, keep nuclear plants, including in Clinton, open for another decade. He said those jobs were very important to the community, but I wonder what kind of reaction we're seeing from other people. And in particular, I'm thinking, Jordan, about the Illinois Manufacturers Association, which also put out a pretty strongly worded statement yesterday saying this is not going to help Illinois' economy at all.
Yeah, in bills like this, especially like the Exelon deal, you're always going to have very, very staunch people who are supporting it and then those who are against it. You know, with Exelon's bill, it was bipartisan with those who voted for it. It was bipartisan with those who thought it was a bad idea. What we're seeing is that bill is going to raise rates, albeit, you know, the governor claims there's going to be caps and it won't be that much. But, you know, when the governor is going around the state making the claim that we can't attract businesses to come here because we have a harsh business climate, the Illinois Manufacturers Association and some pro-business groups are making the point that if you raise their power rates, you know, if you want to open a manufacturing hub here in Illinois now, it's going to cost you more money because you're going to be paying more for power to power that plant. So that was their point. The governor got involved in these negotiations for the Exelon bill because, you know, he wanted to strike a balance, he said, between what the consumers were going to have to pay and saving these jobs. I mean, these jobs, especially to Clinton here in central Illinois, were very important. These were well-paying jobs, and the tax revenue from the plant was also very important to the community. And so I think what this showed us is that lawmakers on both sides of the aisle can come together and get things done when they're is a lot of pressure to save something or do something. I just don't think that the pressure has been there for the budget impasse because of so many of those court orders and consent decrees continuing much of the spending.
Ivan, when we think about the Exelon deal, how quickly did that come together? You know, as Jordan is saying, that it was bipartisan. There were people working together. That did happen pretty quickly, didn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was being discussed for quite a while. I mean, it's been out there for a few months, but ultimately, took a matter of days. This was a bill that they considered during the so-called veto session. So it's basically 6 days that they were in session. But the bill itself, which is this, you know, gigantic, several hundred pages long bill, changed quite a bit, quite a few times from when it was discussed or originally proposed a few weeks ago. And then the last 2 days, we just saw this flurry of activity where both chambers decided to vote on it fairly quickly.
Jordan, and there's been some criticism about the size of the bill as well in terms of I've heard criticism that maybe this wasn't read through thoroughly, that there were lots of things. Who's saying that in particular?
We saw some lawmakers say that on the floor the day that the vote was taken, that this bill is too big. We didn't have time to read it. I mean, you know, it's 500 pages. We don't know.
They literally said we didn't have time to read this bill, bill that was passed.
Yeah. So
sorry, I just wanted everybody to be clear on that point. Okay.
So, you know, it's a huge bill. There was a lot of negotiating as a part of it, and there were a lot of different interests at the table that wanted to be represented, and that's why we see a bill that's that large. And, you know, the opponents are going to say that bill's too big, it's going to collapse under its weight. I mean, those were all things that we were hearing, but in the end, I mean, it got enough votes to pass, and we saw, you know, last minute, the governor's office had amended the bill so that it wouldn't have a take effect date that was immediate, so that that bill could actually get less votes to pass. And so everybody knew that this was going to be a tough sell and a tough vote to take. And so, you know, they negotiated on it very hard for many hours, and they found a bill ultimately that they could get enough votes to pass.
Ivan, I wanted to ask you this week about newly sworn in Comptroller Susana Mendoza pushing bonuses for state workers to the back of the line when it comes to who gets paid when from the limited state funds that are available. What's been her role this first week for her in terms of talking about the budget issue? What has she been saying about this?
Well, I mean, she sent a very clear statement when she decided to push back the employee bonuses. This is very similar to what the previous controller, Leslie Munger, was trying to do in exerting pressure with basically making lawmakers wait for, like everybody else, for their paycheck. But, I mean, what's interesting here is that we really are in very uncharted territory. So it's difficult to say going forward how much she can change things here. I mean, she could do things like what Munger was doing, like delaying the paychecks for lawmakers or doing this with bonuses. But, I mean, when Munger delayed the paychecks for lawmakers, that didn't really change anything.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point, it's really hard to say how much of an influence she's going to have going forward. But mostly that's because, again, we've never been in this position before.
Mm-hmm. Jordan, I know many lawmakers have already left town after adjourning. Is there any sense, are people keeping their schedules open? Would they, I imagine, if they were to be called back for a special session, which would be necessary in the next couple of weeks to pass something new?
The House is scheduled to come back on January 9th, and the Senate adjourned at the will of the chair. So, I mean, Senate President John Cullerton can call them back at any time, and, you know, Speaker Madigan and the governor can all call a special session if they want. Madigan can bring his members back beforehand if he wants. But I don't think, especially with the holidays being at the end of this month, that we're going to see much movement. I mean, if we're already canceling meetings, you know, I don't see how negotiations progress so that we can get a budget and turnaround reforms all drafted up, put together in a package, and ready for a vote in just a few weeks. It doesn't seem like the will is there. Like we saw with the Exelon bill, the will was there, so it took a couple of days to get everything put together. I don't see that same urgency for the budget, especially with canceled meetings and political games still being played.
Ivan, that said, if we look at the end of the month, what happens come January 1st without any deal?
Well, I mean, a lot of the money that these agencies had gotten 6 months ago is running out or has run out. So they're in pretty bad shape to begin with already, because when they did get funding 6 months ago,
it wasn't the full amount, right?
Yeah, it wasn't the full amount, and some of that was going back to paying debts that they had incurred. So in some ways, they are in more dire straits than they've ever been, because in addition to, not getting the full amount, some of the social service providers, for instance, have exhausted their reserves that have helped them get to this point. So when we talk about, you know, January 1st coming along, it's not like, you know, everything is going to break down immediately, but you're going to start seeing places struggling again. And obviously over the last year or so, we've seen a lot of providers make cuts or close their doors. And that's really what we're looking at here.
Mm. Jordan, so it sounds like, I don't know, Jordan, Ivan, we just have less than a minute left here. If you guys have any sense of, it sounds like neither of you are particularly optimistic that we will have a new budget in place by January 1st. Jordan?
I do not see that happening, but, you know, they always surprise you. That's always an option. But right now, I'm not very optimistic that's going to happen before the end of the year.
Ivan?
I think it's a huge long shot.
Ivan Moreno is a supervisory correspondent with the Illinois State House for the Associated Press. Jordan Abadea is a political reporter for WICS News Channel 20 in Springfield. Ivan, Jordan, thanks so much for being with me.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to be talking to the Chicago band Grandkids. They've got a new album out. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Nyla Boodoo. That's the Chicago band Grandkids. It's been more than 3 years since they released their debut album, Timeshare. Back then, the band was living in the Champaign-Urbana area, and that album was one of the most popular to come out of the scene over the past decade. Next week, Grandkids will try to make the same impact in their new home of Chicago with the release of their long-awaited sophomore album called This Guitars. We're joined now by the band's frontwoman, Vivian McConnell. She's on the line with us from Chicago. Hi, Vivian. Welcome to the 21st.
Hey, Nyla, thanks for having me.
So I imagine the last time doing media for the Grandkids album release, I imagine it's a little bit different this time. I wonder if you could start by telling us what's changed in the past 3 years since you guys went from being a mainstay in the central Illinois area to now being based in Chicago.
Yeah, I mean, a lot has happened, that's for sure. We all kind of moved up to Chicago in 2013, kind of as a band, which was really exciting and totally different. And so from then until now, we've just been kind of adjusting as a band. And, you know, we recorded the record, which is really exciting. It's taken us a little bit to put it out, but now we're just really happy to be doing this because it's been a long time coming. But yeah, you know, we're just kind of transitioning. It's been a huge move for all of us, and it's just a little bit tougher up here in Chicago. But it's really exciting to be doing Grandkids right now.
I mentioned it must be tougher to be in Chicago, but at the same time, I imagine you think it was a necessary move for you guys if you want to take your music to another level?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Champaign-Urbana was an awesome place for us to establish our roots, and just become a band. I mean, we all lived within 3 blocks of each other in Urbana, and we practiced in a basement that was super accessible. But it is really important, I think, as a band to grow, to move to a bigger city in certain ways. You know, there's so many people making art and music in Chicago. And so to be around that and to be, you know, surrounding ourselves with a bunch of super inspiring musicians, it's really helped us grow and kind of figure out who we are, what we want to sound like, and it's definitely shifted our sound a lot as well, the move.
And I mean, other than the obvious, because obviously I'm sure it's a lot more expensive and a mm-hmm. little, there's always sort of the hassles of being in a big city. What's been the toughest transition from you guys?
I think just time and energy. I mean, not that it's necessarily easy living in Champaign-Urbana, but it's a little bit different. And I think that we all also kind of graduated college, and as well as transitioning from being, you know, a Champaign-Urbana band to a Chicago band, we were all kind of trying to get our footing as, you know, humans, as, you know, as college grads, I guess. Which has been difficult, you know, trying to find the balance between, okay, how much time do we put into music and how much time do we put into finding a job? You know, trying to find that balance, I think, has been the hardest part, I think.
Yeah. And did you find that it then took you longer, this album? Was that tougher just as you're all sort of, as you said, kind of proceeding with all of these other life things? Was that harder to find to write and come up with this album?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Surprisingly, this album, we recorded it a little bit more quickly. I think because, well, so Timeshare we did record in Chicago, but we were all living in Champaign-Urbana. So when we recorded, we would come up for like a week at a time or a weekend at a time. And the process that we did it was a little more time consuming. And Timeshare was our first record, so we were kind of new. You know, new to the recording game. This time around for This Guitars, we all had a way better idea of what we wanted it to sound like. And it's also a little bit more raw and not necessarily minimalist, but it's not as produced as Timeshare. So we recorded it a lot more quickly because we had a definite path and we were really excited about that because we feel like this record really encapsulates what we want Grandkids to sound like.
Mm-hmm. And did you find that having a 3-year gap, did that put more pressure on you guys to get something out there? I wonder when you're with a band, how much pressure you have to keep producing.
Absolutely. The amount of time between the two records You know, that definitely does grow on you. And, you know, people ask, when's the next grandkids thing coming up? And it was kind of hard for us because we had this record finished for a while. But we kind of just went through some changes and we weren't really sure what was going to happen with us. And a lot of us are kind of starting new projects, but we've always had grandkids. So we were kind of just, we were ready to put it out. And Isaac from Airship Records, I was just talking to him and I sent him the record and he was super helpful in getting this on a roll. And we honestly couldn't have done it without him. So I'm really big shout out to Isaac Arms from Airship Records right now.
Let's take a listen to Seam Ripper. That's the first single off Grandkids' new album, This Guitars. As you heard, you can get it next week through the Champagne-based label that put it out, Airship Records. Part of Seam Ripper. It's the first single off Grandkids' new album, This Guitars. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking to the front woman for the Chicago-based band, Vivian McConnell. Now she's on the line with us from Chicago. You guys got your start in the Champaign-Urbana area. Where did Grandkids come from, Vivian, that name?
You know, we had to pick a name for our first show.
And so you were like, let's call ourselves April. Grandkids.
Yeah, it was kind of one of those things. It was the best option at the time, and it just kind of stuck. There's not really any meaning behind it, except for, I guess, you know, everybody's a grandkid in some way. We had to come up with a name, and it was the one that stuck, and it stuck with us. So.
And you guys had to come up with this. You actually started out as a cover band, playing live events or parties. How did that come about?
Well, we weren't necessarily a cover band. What happened was we all went to school together. I lived below the cello player, our cellist Adam, who used to be a cellist, but now he transitioned to bass, which is a definite sound, you know, that changes a lot on this guitars from timeshare. But Adam and I lived in the same dorm, and then Evan and I met at the mandatory alcohol awareness class at U of I.
And what a great story.
Yeah, and we were also in like the student event planning or the show planning organization. I can't even remember the name. Oh, Star Course, where they bring bands to this university. And then Phil, our drummer, was actually friends with my older brothers who went to U of I. And it really started out, Adam and I just started playing duo. And then Evan kind of hopped in. And then Phil just naturally became our drummer. And our first show was at Canopy Club on April Fool's Day of 2010. So it's been, we've been together for a long time. It's really an exciting thing.
And so I think for fans of your first album, I think what they'll probably notice about this guitar is your new album is how much you guys, in terms of the songwriting, I think it's become, I wonder if you would say you think it's a lot more intricate. And I wonder how you feel about the writing that you did for this new album.
Absolutely. So Timeshare came out of a songwriting period for me that was very, I think, centered on folk and just songs that were straight through that I had brought to the band. And I kind of said, guys, you know, I have the song. Can you put some, you know, put your stuff on it? We'll record it. But this guitar is really exciting because when we were writing the songs, it was much more collaborative, much more democratic. We all have a really distinct voice on this record, and that's why I think I'm just in love with this record. I'm really, you know, I'm really proud of Timeshare, but I think this guitar is a lot more just what Grandkids is, and we all have super unique voices and all have contributed to each song, and I think everybody has a lot of moments on this record that they're really proud of as far as parts. And, you know, Evan, our guitarist, he completely wrote one of the songs and I wrote the lyrics, which that wasn't something that we've never done before. Just a way more democratic, collaborative album, which is always kind of, I think, a goal for a lot of bands. And I'm really happy we achieved it.
And when you say that, I guess you said this after we were coming out of the first song, when we came out of Scene Ripper, that you feel like this has really cemented your sound. What were you guys going for?
I think we wanted to be a little less tender. A lot of our earlier songs are super gentle and beautiful. And as we evolved as a band performing live, we started to get a lot more experimental, but also, you know, still with that folk background or kind of like pop background. So kind of like we wanted to be, I think, a little more experimental. I think that's maybe the right word to use. And just a little more rough around the edges, because our first record is very just smooth. And this one's a little more jagged and sharp.
That's Vivian McConnell. She's the front woman of the Chicago band Grandkids. They're releasing their sophomore album, This Guitar's, next week. Let's go out by hearing another song off the record. This one's called Dinner Women. Vivian, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Nyla.
That's it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. All of those links, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, follow us on social media, is all at our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Howla Delahi, Christine Herman, and Sean Newman. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.